new survey shows Holocaust denial among young people in Ireland is rising, and it's happening at a moment of extreme political tension globally. And at the same time as we mark Holocaust Commemoration Day, questions have arisen around the safety of the Jewish community. So how should it be remembered, especially as a conflation of Jewish identity with the actions of the Israeli state becomes more prominent? It's News Talk Daily. I'm Tara Duggan. Nearly 10% of young adults in Ireland believe the Holocaust didn't happen, and over half don't know that 6 million Jews were murdered. This should also read as a warning. Holocaust denial and distortion are encountered regularly online. Jewish identity itself has become politicised in ways that are both unfair and dangerous. For many Jewish people, including those living here in Ireland, there's a growing fear of being forced into this binary that remembering the Holocaust somehow means endorsing the actions of the Israeli state, or that criticising Israel erases Jewish trauma. On Holocaust Commemoration Day, remembering history has become harder and more emotionally charged. But how has it come to this? Now, to talk to me about that complexity, I'm joined by Ria Cherniak-Lebov, a Jewish woman living in Ireland, the granddaughter of a Holocaust escapee and a vocal critic of Israel's actions in Gaza. Ria, can I start by asking you what your immediate response was when you read about this survey?
I would love to say that I was really surprised, but I wasn't quite as surprised. I think that whether or not it's involved in a school education or in the media, I think young people are consuming an awful lot of their news online on social media. And I think that our school system obviously isn't doing an adequate job of fully educating them on the history, whether it's World War II, the Holocaust specifically. So it is very disappointing. But that survey also highlighted a desire to know more about the Holocaust. So I think Holocaust Education Ireland do an incredible job, and they do an awful lot of outreach. And they even have relatives of Holocaust survivors and escapees visit schools and communities. And I think those kind of first-person experiences often resonate with young people very much.
I'm sure they do, but that type of education has to be sought rather than it is delivered.
Yeah.
Do you think that there should be some consideration given to what is the history curriculum? Because it's become more of an optional subject now than it would have been even in my day back in the 80s.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a history teacher and I don't 100% know what's on the Leaving Cert these days, but I do remember when I was there, kind of 20th century history was really just on the senior syllabus. So if you didn't choose Leaving Cert history, your history didn't carry you up to the present day, or it didn't explore World War II. And I don't think that's really acceptable. I think, especially in the context of current events, not just in Israel and in Palestine, but around the world, I think it's increasingly important that people understand history and how that affects current politics, economics, everything. And I think young people need to understand the background to things, because social media doesn't give you that depth.
And speaking about background, you'll be lighting a candle for your grandfather and the family at the commemoration. Tell me a little bit about his story.
So his name was Harry Cherniak, and he came from a town called Konin in Poland. And Harry travelled actually to the UK to work in the 1930s under a pseudonym, and then was deported back to Poland, and was very lucky to escape basically when it was an escapable time, as opposed to his, I think over 30 members of our family perished in the Holocaust. But it was heartbreaking to find out nearly 10 years ago there was an archive that was made available to the public, where all of the immigration records since 1900 were made publicly accessible. So my uncle Morris put in an application for his father's immigration records, and it actually came very sensitively from the archivist with a trigger warning, because she said, "I'm so sorry if this was news to you, but we got a 30-page document about his immigration into Ireland, and it had a record of all of his applications for naturalisation and Irish citizenship, which he was systematically denied until he died in the 1950s. But what we didn't realise was that he had actually been married with two children before the Holocaust, and his wife Bloom and his two children, Julius and Frieda, had perished in Auschwitz, and we didn't know that they had existed. And my own mother was also called Frieda Cherniak, so he had named his first daughter after his own mother. And then when she died and he started his life again, he had two more children in Ireland and named one of them the same name. And my mum passed away not knowing about the sister who had perished in Auschwitz, which I just... it absolutely sends shivers down my spine that we didn't know that.
And why do you think you didn't know? Why do you think he never told you about that? Was it a case of that was part of the process for him to move forward and continue to live his life?
Probably. I mean, he died of a heart attack when my mum was only six and my uncle was four. I think a huge amount of Holocaust survivors and escapees had such guilt, as like survivor's guilt, that they had somehow been the only person to have to gotten somewhere safe. And I think our extended family, I had a great uncle Isaac, and I remember him saying there was always mystery about Harry Cherniak. Like, I think they knew he had a life there, but it wasn't almost polite or it wasn't sensitive to ask people about their life before the Holocaust.
At this point, Ria, I want to bring in former speechwriter Sarah Horowitz speaking at the General Assembly of the Jewish Foundation of North America. Let's just have a listen to Sarah's words.
I think, unfortunately, the very smart, I think, bet that we made on Holocaust education to serve as anti-Semitism education, in this new media environment, I think that is beginning to break down a little bit. Because, you know, Holocaust education is absolutely essential. But I think it may be confusing some of our young people about anti-Semitism because they learn about big, strong Nazis hurting weak, emaciated Jews. And they think, oh, anti-Semitism is like anti-Black racism, right? Powerful white people against powerless Black people. So when on TikTok all day long they see powerful Israelis hurting weak, skinny Palestinians, it's not surprising that they think, oh, I know, the lesson of the Holocaust is you fight Israel. You fight the big, powerful people hurting the weak people.
Can I ask you your views on her points there that she made?
Well, I guess I found that moment so... it was the biggest unmasking I've ever come across, where I think trying to take a lesson from the Holocaust is overly simplistic, and it's actually kind of damaging. There is, as far as I'm concerned, obviously Holocaust education is so important, but if there's a message to be taken, it's more about being able to spot the signs of a genocide, not being complicit in a genocide. I think that we often walk around the world when we read about the Holocaust going, well, what would I have done in those times? Would I have turned a blind eye? Would I have turned my neighbours in? And I think what we're seeing now in the rise of whether it's anti-immigration speech or whether it's anti-genocide in Palestine, we're seeing what people are doing in real time when faced with like overwhelming evidence of a genocide. Mm. And I find it really, really problematic that someone like Sarah Horowitz would say, she actually said that Holocaust education had backfired. And there's no, I think that that's kind of like, it's very like Jewish exceptionalism, as if the lesson is to solely protect Jews. And obviously, if we're going to learn anything from history, and that's the point of studying history, is so that we don't allow it to repeat itself. And it shouldn't matter to people whether the people being murdered are Jewish, Christian, Muslim. Like, the context of it will always be different, but the overall pattern of dehumanization of certain members of society being relegated to being second-class citizens, like, we should recognize those patterns wherever they occur, and that's what we should be learning, obviously, from Holocaust education.
You've spoken powerfully about the damage done by conflating Jewish identity with the actions of the Israeli state. What does that conflation do to ordinary Jewish people?
Well, I think it has so many different layers of impact. I think it can be anything from just this quiet presumption that most of us face that we are pro-Israel just because we're Jewish. And I find that really offensive, that like just because I'm Jewish or and my own father is Israeli, but even the assumption that all Israelis think in the same political way. A lot of Israelis there, they're talking now about like an exodus of more liberal Israelis because they don't want to live under a far-right regime. And so this presumption that then when they're abroad that they are pro-Netanyahu is equally hurtful. Like, but I think this conflation on a more serious level, obviously it's horrific that there's been anti-Semitic attacks in Manchester on a synagogue on Yom Kippur, in Bondi Beach on a Hanukkah celebration. And that conflation, you're targeting a community who practice a religion who ostensibly have nothing to do with a state that's carrying out a genocide.
And so how much harder then against the spectre of those attacks, and you mentioned Bondi, how much harder has it become then to hold Holocaust commemorations in this current climate?
Well, I think last year there was heightened concerns over the security of the event. And when you say it's harder, I think when you have a really, really deep conviction in what the essence of Holocaust education is and commemoration, for me, I would just doggedly continue anything I would have done before. I think its importance is probably even more relevant. And I guess, like, I can't personally... I mean, we all do our little bit just by being in the world, but there are overarching kind of narratives online that are so detrimental, but I can't control them. All I have to do is speak my truth and say, this is deeply important, but we cannot allow it to be weaponized and taken on like this narrative that justifies war crimes. So like I was talking to somebody during the week about the amount of online comments as a public-facing Jewish person. Like recently I wrote an article criticizing something that Israel was doing and I was called a capo. And for anyone of the listeners who doesn't know what a capo is, it's basically like somebody in a concentration camp, like an inmate who was given special privileges to basically work for the Nazis and police their fellow inmates. And the assumption that you can call a Jewish person a capo because they are perceived a traitor. There's a lot of language coming out that from the Holocaust. And it's being weaponized to censor people and to punish people who speak out.
And so therefore, do you feel Jewish voices, and you can understand why you might feel this way, that the Jewish voices are being misrepresented or even dampened down in this public debate?
I think Jewish voices that express nuance are dampened down. I think it's really, really simple to have a black and white kind of polarized argument about, well, this is a rise in anti-Semitism. And I am not here to gaslight people that there isn't a rise in anti-Semitism. Unfortunately, there is. But that doesn't mean that you turn a blind eye to war crimes. It doesn't mean that you don't call out double standards. It doesn't mean that you stop speaking the truth about the ways in which things are weaponized, because it's not acceptable just because like one tragedy took place. And it's like the tragedy of the century that we're seeing weaponized to justify another like horrific attack on human rights and life. So I really just, I hate when people simplify it into this as if it's somehow Jews all feel that they need Israel for safety. You know, the new historian Ilan Pappe often said that Zionism was the result, or the success or proliferation of Zionism was a sign of Europe's inability to deal with anti-Semitism. So the only reason you would need Zionism is because Europe couldn't cope with integrating Jewish people and making reparations effectively after the war. And that's why so many people continue to go to Israel. There's every time I've seen a rise in anti-Semitism, I see more Jewish people flock to Israel. And I find that really troubling.
Are you fearful for yourself and for the Jewish community because of this rise in anti-Semitism?
When I think...
As a Jewish person living in Ireland, specifically.
I wouldn't be fearful of violence. I think that I would be... Like, I know that there's a rise in, like, graffiti, people saying horrifically Nazi-esque ideology, or spraying swastikas, or harassing Jewish people who they... or where they live, or their business places. I'm not... I mean, thankfully, I don't think that we live in a society here in Ireland that that I'm fearful of extreme violence against Jewish people. But just even that that they should be cognizant of that and require security, like, that's not right. Like, places of worship shouldn't require security. Celebrating religious holidays should not require security.
You mentioned a physical threat, but yet you've also talked to us about the threats that you've received online. That's an emotional threat. That's an emotional attack.
It is. Yeah. And I think, there's been an awful lot of them. Like even the amount of people, if I was on a little video being interviewed about something, and the amount of messages or comments that were like, I can't believe this woman is still wearing a Star of David. And just absolutely shaming it and saying that it was a symbol of Zionism. And I was like, you don't get to appropriate that, or you don't get to assume that I'm, that I'm violent, that I'm pro an apartheid regime. You don't get to project any of that. For me, the Star of David is so loaded, because obviously coming from a background where people were persecuted in the Holocaust and made to wear a gold Star of David on them, there's something about that, that when Jewish people choose to wear a Star of David, it could be seen that they're honouring their family, or that they refuse to become invisible out of fear. And people don't really understand the nuance of that, or how damaging that is to shame somebody for wearing one.
What do you think, Ria, gets lost when the Holocaust memory is dragged into the contemporary political arguments instead of being seen and viewed as a moral warning in and of itself? Do you see that the discussion maybe gives rise to viewpoints that shouldn't be platformed?
Well, I've seen
impossible as it is to police that in this era.
It is impossible, but there are points where, like, I heard somebody who is an ardent supporter of Israel compare BDS to the boycotts of Jewish businesses in 1930s Germany, and I said, BDS, boycott, divest and sanction, it's not about religion. It's a way of dealing with a rogue state that you are entitled to boycott them and do anything in your power to hold them to account. And that is the most offensive conflation, that you're saying, oh, you're punishing Jewish businesses. I was like, well, the Jews in German 1930s had done absolutely nothing but mind their own business and carry on their lives. And so I find the conflation and the weaponization on both sides, whether you're in the pro-Palestine solidarity movement, I've heard some very dangerous accusations and conspiracy theories that are very uncomfortable, and I'm a member of the solidarity movement. And similarly, I've been in circles, whether in the Jewish community or in circles where they would defend Israel, where the way people have talked about the Holocaust are equally problematic.
What responsibility do you think, we started off this conversation referencing the education system, referencing how people are learning their history maybe through social media and TikToks, and not questioning, you know, what the algorithms essentially are presenting to them. What responsibility do you think then do schools and the media and those platforms have when it comes to discussing the facts?
Well, I think I'd also add in that Sarah Hurwitz, what she was talking about the effect of TikTok on people, and she was talking explicitly at the Jewish Federations of North America General Assembly, claiming basically that young Jews had because they'd lost the narrative that she would have liked them to have because of TikTok and social media. But what she was saying was because they were witnessing like extreme carnage. So social media is twofold. It's showing you the truth on the ground, let's say in Gaza, something we didn't have during the Holocaust. We got to claim that we didn't know what was going on. Mm. We don't get to claim that anymore. We're seeing extreme violence and destruction, but at the same time, it is flattening out certain points of nuance and debate, a bit like X. I mean, how many characters does it take to actually properly understand something so complex? And I think my day job, I'm actually a lecturer in NCAD in a department called Critical Cultures, and we teach critical theory, and we teach, like, whether it's media literacy or just the debate we're trying to have with students is about that, about seeing things from every perspective and being able to tease it out for yourself and not always just taking the dominant narrative. And I think that just in the age of whether it's AI or more polemic kind of news talking points and clickbait, that we need to just nurture critical thinking and dialogue. Mm.
Finally, Ria, what would you say to those nearly 10% of Irish young adults who believe the Holocaust didn't happen? What's your message to them?
Well, I mean, it's such a position of privilege to be able to believe that's like that anything that is so barbaric, you just don't want to look at it. And I think like when you think about the amount of Jews that were killed, it's greater than the current population of Ireland. And if you imagine every person on this island suddenly being murdered, I think like I think Irish people, we are very much aware of the impact of the famine. But I mean, there could well be, I know people who've grown up in Britain and not been taught about the famine.
Yeah.
And it's so important, like not only to understand your own post-colonial history, but to really recognise all of the horrific histories that like, I wish didn't happen and I wish they didn't exist, but they did. And we can't really afford to be putting our head in the sand about any of them. And I think as far as genocides are concerned, we're having this moment where we're acknowledging the barbaric genocide of indigenous people in North America or in Australia. And there's so many uncomfortable truths. And I think it just gets too much for young people sometimes. But that's why we need to be careful and caring to each other and just be able to talk it out. Because, yeah, it's very overwhelming having to digest that much information that's so traumatic.
Rhea Cherniak-Labov, thank you very much for joining us on News Talk Daily today. Don't forget you can listen back to all News Talk Daily podcasts on the Go Loud player. But for now, from me, Tara Duggan, chat to you tomorrow.